I'm glad I'm first because I get that part over with. And now after an hour, I'm going to get to listen to the rest of it and learn. And I find that much easier than doing the speaking. When Maxie asked me to be on the program, he didn't tell me at first that I was going to be the first speaker. But then in his office one day, he was encouraging me that the first speaker wants to start off with a bang and get things really started and set the pace for it and everything like this, and really made me feel comfortable, you know, putting that kind of pressure on me. So, Maxie, this is your fault. If it starts off with a bang. Well, this really is an illustration that I got off the internet. Last year, I spoke on Out of the Darkness of Atheism and used so much of the material that I've studied over the years last year concerning does God exist and the proof of God and coming out of the darkness of atheism. That yet this year, I said, well, what am I going to do since I've used so much of the material that I'm familiar with? Well, I got on the internet, and there is more material there under atheism, creationism, and Big Bang, and origins, and things like this than I could ever, ever digest. In fact, I downloaded over 100 pages in this notebook, and all the quotes that I'll be using today are in this notebook. If you'd like to look at them further, I'll have this most of the week that you can look at them, and you'll find them in here. But one of the things they said, they began with this, because as we talk about does God really exist, we go back to the beginning, we go back to origins. And those who believe in atheism, those who deny that God really exists, tell us that one of the things that we can do to understand our universe today is to blow a balloon about halfway up. Draw on it the galaxies of the universe. Well, I did that kind of partially. Then he says, continue to blow it up slowly, and you will understand how our universe is expanding. Then it says, to understand its beginning, let the air out of the balloon. And 12 to 20 billion years ago, it was down to a point where the galaxies, everything began to implode upon themselves until all that was left was smaller than an atom. And most of the scientists believe that there was nothing left. Another example they gave was an ice cream cone. Take it and follow the lines of an ice cream cone down. The top of it would be the galaxy, the size of our galaxy and universe today. And follow it down to the beginning. And when those points meet, that tiny, tiny dot that really is nothing, that is the beginning. No time, no space, no matter, nothing, except some say a tiny, tiny dot smaller than our universe, smaller than our atom. Does God really exist? I want to read to you a lesson that was being taught on evolution on the internet. Anthony updated this April 13th, 1998, under the Area 1, the Big Bang. This infinitely small point, this nothing at the beginning, for yet unknown reasons, lost stability and exploded in a flash of energy. That explosion, the Big Bang, created the entire universe and all that is in it basically from nothing. The Big Bang created, notice that word, created, all matter in the universe, created space, created time. Before the Big Bang, there was nothing. Then in less than 1/1,000,000th of the time it takes to blink, the universe and all that it contained exploded from that nothingness. It started expanding outward, evolving quickly until it reached the level of maturity you see today. Then they list about three basic steps in the development of the universe. The beginning, which was the Big Bang. Then they talk about this big mass of matter, mostly hydrogen, collapses into a disc-like shape. And then inside of all of that, our little tiny Earth begins to condense until finally it's very volatile, very hot, with an iron core. And then under these three major steps, they have dozens of sub-steps. And that doesn't include each step of getting the right angle of our earth, the right tilt, the right speed, the right place, the right water landmass, the right distance from the sun. It doesn't include man's evolving from a single cell and involving of the cell and then evolving from the single cell till now. And each one of these sub-steps, the chances of it happening, these scientists admit that each step would be one in trillions. One in trillions. And when you amass all of it together, even Carl Sagan writes, the late Carl Sagan that was so popular on television and writing and in lectures, writes that the possibility of all of it happening is one, and to write the number would take almost 2 million pages. That's almost 4,000 books of 500 pages each just to write the possibility of it happening. And yet, the Big Bang is the most popular theory of how our earth originated among scientists today. And then they get upset when we refuse to accept such odds. They think we're irrational because we won't accept this theory. Winning the Texas lottery, perhaps that's a bad example, but it's a good one kind of thing. What are the chances of doing that? Once in a while, you know, the numbers are rolled out of this little machine on Wednesday night sometimes, and I'll try to guess what before it rolls out the number. Once in a great while, I'll get one number. But what if someone won the lottery? Boy, what chances? You know, what odds? Let me ask you this. What if someone won the lottery three times in a row? Would anybody get suspicious? Would there be great investigation? Certainly there would. Even if they won it twice in a row, people say, hey, something's wrong here. You can't do that. That's impossible. Three times. But let me tell you this. If someone won the Texas lottery a million times in a row, it wouldn't be anything in comparison to what the numbers these fellows believe. That our world began without God with a big bang. And then they want us to swallow it. The bottom line is that most of the foremost proponents of this theory don't want to believe in God. As Romans 1:21 says, and in that section there, it says, they do not like to retain God in their knowledge. And this is the only alternative, to try to come up with some kind of way that our universe began without God. They say it's easier to believe that we came from nothing than that we came from God. On the TV program Think Tank, Mr. Wattenberg, the host, asked Richard Dawkins where this nothing came from. Now, Richard Dawkins is a professor of science in Oxford University. He's one of the main proponents of atheism in our world today. He's spoken on dozens of our university campuses in the United States. He has written many, many books, The Blind Watchmaker, Timing Mount Improbable, and others, in trying to explain away design and trying to explain away God. And he was asked this question, where that nothing came from. And Mr. Dawkins replied, that's the important question. But all I would say is that it's a lot easier to say where nothing came from than to say where 30 million species of highly complicated organisms plus a super intelligent God came from, and that's the alternative. Is it really easier? Is it really easier to believe that we came from nothing than that we came from God? How many years of education does it take to believe what Mr. Dawkins believed? But I tell you what, every nation, civilized and uncivilized, from the natives in the darkest area it's easy for them to believe in a designer, in a God. It takes years of education, the wrong kind of education, to disbelieve in God, to deny that God really does exist. Is it easier to believe that matter, inorganic matter, created mind, or that mind created matter? Is it easier to believe that nothing always existed, or that God always existed? Is it easier to believe that there was nothing, and this nothing became unstable and exploded into a flash of hydrogen as large as our universe? I think my mind had to be as unstable as a theory to really believe that. Unstable, all right. Or is it easier to believe that there's far greater stability in the beginning? God created the heavens and the earth. In the beginning, there's your time. God, there's your force. Created, there's your action. Heaven, there's your space. The earth, there's your mass, there's your matter. In the first verse of Genesis, God really does exist. Man could not have written such great wisdom as that, not even in our day, much less in the days of Moses. So with these few verses, all questions of origin, design, purpose, time, space began to fall into place. God's design. That's what we're going to be talking most about today, because God gives His design as one of the greatest influences upon people to show that there really is a God. Romans 1:20-22. The invisible things of Him from the creation of the world are clearly seen, being understood by the things that are made, even His eternal power and Godhead, so that they are without excuse. Hebrews 11:1. Now faith is a substance of things hoped for, the evidence of things not seen. Sadly, in Psalms 14:1, it says, the fool has said in his heart, what? There is no God. But one of our favorite verses in this discussion, it always will be for those of us who wear the name of Christ, is Psalms 19:1-2. The heavens declare the glory of God, and the firmament showeth His handiwork. Day unto day utter speech, and night unto night shows what? It shows knowledge behind creation. It shows that there's design and a designer behind our world. But design is under attack. One of the things that really amused me as I was studying through all of this material on the internet is how atheists and proponents of the Big Bang Theory and everything, how they tiptoe around this word design. I found all of these phrases. They use apparent design, seeming design, looks as if it were design, non-design, illusion of design. And on Technopolitics, a television program, Mr. Ruse, who's a Harvard biology teacher, a Darwinian, and Mr. Glassman, the show host, were having a discussion about what Dr. Behe had talked about, of how DNA must have come from God. Mr. Ruse says, that's the point. We do see design-like effects. See that word design, how I use it? Design-like effects. Mr. Glassman, the host, so does that mean you think a creator created this design? Oh, no, I didn't say that. I said design-like effects. So, yes, I want to say I expect to see design-like effects in the world. The point is, natural selection done it. Exact quotation. Mr. Glassman, so Michael Ruse, Why aren't we saying, hey, look, there really is an intelligent designer? Why is it? Why do you resist? Why do so many scientists just don't want to admit that that's a possibility? Mr. Ruse, first of all, we're talking about refurbishing a very old idea. And that's what they like to do with design. They like to put it in the background as having, it's old, it's outdated, it's outmoded, it doesn't apply today. But why do they write books like The Blind Watchmaker and Climbing Mountain Probable still trying to explain it away if it's such an old idea and everybody's proving it wrong? It's a very old idea. The second point I'd like to make is that there's going to be a problem with the design issue. Like mutations which cause great human suffering and these sort of things. Now, when pressured about design, what does Mr. Ruse do? Now, he's a Harvard teacher of science. What does he do? He says, it's design-like. It's a very old idea. And then he switches to the problem of human suffering to get away from it. Now, these are our professors that are teaching our young people today. How much do they really have as evidence that there is no design? How they tiptoe around it. Andrew Pomienkowski reviews Darwin's Black Box, written by Behe. He says, Behe is good at exposing the evolutionary thought in the field of biochemistry, but he is a part of the problem, falling back on the old limp idea of design. So you have the latest, no doubt not the last, attempt to put God back into nature, but this is a old blind alley. Biochemistry is yet another biology awaiting Darwinism evolution. Dawkins, Richard Dawkins, when he was asked, why are we here? He said, we are here because we're evolved, and that's the only way why should ever be answered. But the ultimate meaning of the word why, I do not regard, he says, as a legitimate question. I would just say, that's a silly question. Don't ask it. The greatest defender of atheism today, if you ask him, why are we here? He says, we evolved. That's the only answer to why. Any other answer is a silly question. So they can degrade our arguments about design, call them blind alleys. They can call them, it's just and Darwinian revolution will someday disprove all of these ideas. But in the meantime, the evidences of the old blind, of the old argument of design just keep on multiplying, brethren. Black boxes in science simply mean something that we know it works, but we don't know how it works. In other words, if a jungle native came out and saw a car for the first time, he'd probably think it worked like Fred Flintstone. You know, your feet went through the floorboard and you ran along, and that's what made it go. Well, to him, what's under the hood would be a black box. He wouldn't know what's under there. Well, back in Darwin's time, the cell was a black box. They thought it was just a blob of protoplasm, you know, and that there was really not much to it. But biochemistry and modern microscopes have opened up the little black boxes. And we can see inside the cell, and we see DNA, and we see genetics, and we see things we never, never thought possible. Now, are these studies, these molecular studies of cells, are they supporting natural selection and evolution when we open up the little black boxes, or are they supporting God really does exist? That's one of the biggest arguments going on over the internet nowadays is over biochemistry and the study of cells. Are they really designed, or could they happen naturally? Dr. Michael Behe of Lehigh University was an evolutionist until he began to study, he teaches biochemistry in Lehigh University. And as he began to study deeper and deeper into this, he studied himself out of the idea of evolution, at least down on the cell level. Because he came up with an idea that said, hey, all of this just couldn't have been put together by chance. One of his best examples, he says, is something, he calls it irreducible complexity. He says it's like a mouse trap. He says that you have to have all of the parts there for it to work. And why would evolution design this thing that holds the trap together when it's set? Why would it design that if all the other parts weren't there? You don't need that. There's never a natural selection to want to make any one of these parts without all of it being put together. It's only when you put all of them together that the mousetrap will work. Take any of the parts off and it doesn't work. And he says it's that same way, even more complicated, more complex, in the tiniest of cells, even in bacteria, the smallest of the cells. He says that bacteria have a little tail on them called a flagellum. A flagellum. And this little tail helps them to motivate and move. And we can't even see the bacteria, you know, through small microscopes. You have to get these big things to be able to do that. And now they're looking inside of these. And you know what they found there? 1996, at the Mir conference, Dr. Behe was on television. And he says, Darwinism, natural selection cannot help produce them because they have a property called irreducible complexity. That is, they consist of a number of parts, all of which must be present for the machine to work. On a public TV show called Think Tank, they asked Behe and Dawkins to have a debate. Behe said, yeah, I'll be glad to have the debate. Dawkins refused. He says, well, I don't have a real deep education in biochemistry, so I just wouldn't really know. But then Dawkins went on this Think Tank program by himself. He wouldn't go with Behe, but he went by himself. And I went through and I finally found there's the transcripts of where Dawkins was on this Think Tank program. And they were talking about Behe's book. And here's what Dawkins says. What Behe has done is to take the standard argument, which dates back to the 19th century, the argument of irreducible complexity. For example, bacteria have a flagellum, which is a kind of whip-like tail by which they swim. And Behe asserts this is irreducibly complex. Therefore, God made it. Behe, now this is the way they look at it, Behe should stop being lazy and should get up and think for himself about how the flagellum evolved instead of this cowardly, lazy, copping out by saying simply, oh, I don't think how it came about, therefore it must have been designed. That's how they attack design. We don't have the answers. The heat of this irreducible complexity has really spread. Even on Microsoft campus, they gathered together a number of scholars from different areas. One of them was Mr. Paul Goss of Harvard University, Mr. Michael Ruse of the editor, but is it science? On the creationist sides were Dr. Michael Behe, Philip Johnson, and Mr. Stephen Meyer of the Discovery Institute. The announcer begins by saying this, how did we get here? Now, all these men are gathered here for a debate on Microsoft University. How do we get here? Most scientists believe that microscopic forms evolved into human beings. B says that when you look at the architecture of cells, the inescapable conclusion is not that random mutation was at work, but that there was an intelligent designer of human DNA, which is why Michael Behe has caused such a stir in Darwinian circles. Now, Dr. Stephen Meyer explains how this little bacteria works, and he says this. He says, we found that what makes it apparently simple system work is an extraordinary complex motor that looks like something Mazda designed. A rotary engine, Mazda, remember? It has a rotary motor, it has a stator, a propeller, it has O-rings, it has bushings, it has a drive shaft. All these parts are made out of proteins, some 50 separate proteins, each of which are functionally necessary to the system as a whole. So instead of just a simple mousetrap, you've got a rotary engine and this little tiny bacteria. And so that's what convinced Dr. Michael Behe that, hey, this couldn't have evolved. But now he's on this program, and Mr. Paul Goss of Harvard University makes some statements, and then he concludes, no serious person argues with the fact of evolution. Now, the announcer summarizes all of this at the engine. He says, Goss says that without knowing previous links in the evolutionary chain, one can't know whether the complexity of the mousetrap, of the cell, is irreducible or not. Goss believes that as we learn more about the evolution of cells, Behe's theory will collapse. Then the conclusion of the announcer is, but given the data available, no one has yet been able to prove Behe wrong. So the evidence for design that God really exists still triumph. These things are clearly seen as God has declared, even under the most powerful, powerful microscopes that we have, except by those whose foolish hearts are darkened. Romans 1:21. Atheists offer at least four major objections to the idea of design. Number one, they say irreducible complexity is just another form of the worn-out, outdated, unprovable arguments of design. It's just worn out, it doesn't, and they try to get rid of it that way. Number two, there is presently unexplainable complexity, but natural selection will eventually proven to be the answer. You talk about fate. Someday, we evolutionists are going to be able to prove it's wrong, that God didn't really create it. Number three, now creation design is just unscientific and should never seriously be considered as an alternate option of explaining the origin of our world. Number four, and they come back to this time and time again, no serious person, especially any serious person of science, will argue with the fact of evolution, and they mean the evolution from nothing to what we have now. Let's consider this last point farther. No serious person argues with the fact of evolution. How valid is their evolutionary tree? As I studied and waded through all the material that was on TV, it reminded me of a long hall, long corridor. What they have done is put a picture of man on this end and a picture of a little cell on this end. And then they go out and find all the pictures they can, all the bones they can, and they even sketch a lot of pictures in and try to fill in the gaps. That's as ridiculous as me taking the Biltmore Castle. Have you ever been there? I have. And I stood in front of that thing and I said, oh boy, look what evolution did. But, you know, it must have been some storm that went through the forest to set this thing down here, you know. That's as ridiculous as saying that we've been set down here. In fact, it's far less ridiculous because we're a lot more complicated than the Biltmore Castle. We've got better plumbing system. We've got better air conditioning and heating systems. We've got better foundations. We've got a lot of things far, far greater than the Biltmore will ever have. And who would stand in front of the Biltmore and say, hey, it evolved? But they'll look at man and woman and family and say they just happened. They evolved. But I can prove the Biltmore evolved. You know, by the same, what do? We put the Biltmore at one end of the hall down here. We put a wormhole. Now we go find out, we go find pictures of a foxhole. We find pictures of a cave. We find pictures of a teepee made by the Indians. An igloo made by the Eskimos. Old log cabin in the early Americas. Then a one-bedroom farmhouse with the outdoor toilet. Then we find indoor plumbing. Then we find air conditioning in three bedrooms, 20 bedrooms. And then we have the Biltmore, a perfect line of how we can prove that the Biltmore evolved. All by natural selection. What kind of natural selection? Tornadoes, hurricanes, winds, lightnings, rains. All of these went through and just, I've been in three hurricanes in Bermuda. Three hurricanes in Bermuda. And not a one of them left any kind of a house that was better, in better condition after it went over than before it was there. Not a one of them. And yet this is natural selection at work. This is natural force at work. After a tornado goes through a forest, how many of us would go out there and expect to find any kind of hut or house because of that tornado? We'd find a lot of destruction. We'd find a lot of garbage. But you know what's wrong with this whole picture in the halls that evolutionists put up there on the evolutionist tree for us? There's no intermediates. There is no from one species to another species. In fact, there shouldn't be any species because only God creates after its kind. There shouldn't be any species. It just should be intermediates. All of us should just be transforming all the time. And for there to be an actual selection, there has to be something to select, brethren. There has to be a lot of garbage out there, and natural selection picks the best out of that. But you look in that tiny cell, that tiny bacteria with the flagellum, and you don't find any garbage. It's perfect. It's complete. Nothing for natural selection to select. It's already the best that there is for the purpose that it is to serve. That's true of the ant. As we walk up the corridor, there's the little cell, there's the ant, there's the spider. I wish we had time to go into some of these because they're fascinating. Even the woodpecker, man, you look at it and its capabilities of doing what it does. And then you come to the final picture and there's man. Not just man, but a family. Man and woman evolving at the same time so that they're perfectly compatible and suit each other's needs in every way. Oh, it's sad. I feel sorry for Richard Dawkins and those who deny the existence of God so that they may be their own God, make their own standards, and do their own thing. They don't have this stability that we have in Jesus Christ. Richard Dawkins in Climbing Mount Improbable describes an eye and the evolution of an eye. And he says, basically, well, 50% of eye is better than 49%, and 49% of an eye is better than 48%. Well, if it doesn't work, it's not very good at all. In fact, he brags about the idea that in 1994, Nielsen and Flegger's computer analysis, they took a transparent, a flat of transparent layer and put on top of that a flat retina, and on top of that a flat piece of tissue. And they put this thing in the computer, and it finally folded up into something that looks like an eye. It only took, Dawkins says, 364,000 generations of fish to produce this. But of course, you have to start with these three things. Now, what do those 364,000 generations of fish do with that partial eye? If evolution is true, we should all be those things. We shouldn't have a family as a final picture. We should have more like Star Wars, people of every kind, every nation, every kind of intelligence, still evolving, still changing, still pieces of us that we don't know why it's there. What did a bird do when it was, you know, before it had its feathers and couldn't fly? What did it do with those things sticking out here before it had feathers and could fly? What does a spider do before he can make a web and catch his food? What does an ant do before he has the instinct that he has to build and to provide for the winter? But don't think evolutionists are ill-equipped. They are armed with chalkboards full of equations, with charts of geographical strata, evolutionary trees, impressive degrees upon their wall. And our children and even adults that go to their classrooms can be swayed a lot of times. And they don't stay in the classroom. They're on our television. They're everywhere else. In our books that we read, in our newspapers. I spent hours on the internet researching some of the latest teachings. And they seem to have even more material under the word creation than we have. They're out there and they're in abundance. I want to read to you, on the internet, they were suggesting ways to destroy the faith of creationists in one place that I found. One prominent biology professor encouraged the teachers to tell your students to keep their faith, but then assure the student that faith is greater when it doesn't really coincide with the truth and with the facts. Another suggested tell your creation students, especially their parents, especially high school students, that you teach the theory, that you teach evolution only as a theory, but you don't let them know that you can teach theory as strongly as fact. Here's one that I want to read if I have time to read all of it. It's an exchange between Dr. Nicole Okoski Southeastern Louisiana University, and it's written to Dr. Hugh Wilson of Texas A&M. She writes, "Dear Dr. Wilson, I'm an instructor at SLU. I have embroiled myself in a debate with creationists who are trying to pass a disclaimer against evolution in public schools, and they've asked me to explain the appearance of flowering plants. I don't know much about it." I'll skip that part. Dr. Hugh Wilson of Texas A&M replies, "Hello, the emergence of flowering plants in terms of time, available data, and pattern of origin, etc., is similar to that of the mammals to the extent that the end products are well-defined, but it gets a bit scarce as you move toward the base of the tree. You should be aware that the community of taxonomists that should be prepared to deal with this problem is essentially non-functional as a source of support, at least from my experience. They offer no substantial help for colleagues willing to engage creationists, often pros in debate. Thus, you're pretty much on your own with regard to preparation. But I've had good luck with the following approach. Number one, open with the importance of basic biology to medicine and agriculture, to oil exploration, and focus on the complexity of living systems and the need to rely on scientific specialists, especially geologists and biologists. Number two, attack the academic credentials of your opponent. Number three, don't follow the paths they expect. They are expecting a legitimate debate. Don't allow the discussion to move toward detail. The general take-home message is this, in essence, for the audience. We are discussing education in the biological sciences for the future generation of physicians. If you or your family encounter a terminal disease, do you want your physician to have an educational background in modern biological science or the Old Testament? At least that is one tactic. Good luck with the debate. I wonder, when she received that reply, what do you do? Well, we don't really have the information to have a legitimate debate and to prove that they're wrong, but you attack their academics. You tell them that, do you want your doctor to be, if you're dying, to be well-versed in the Old Testament or in biological science, not thinking that we can be both. And on with your debate. And so as I read through these things, brethren, we have so much to be thankful for that our God has given us. The heavens and the earth that declare His glory. There's so much more that could be said. Might suggest that you buy the book. I couldn't get all of it in. But there is one thing. The heavens that are now are reserved by God. And the end of this whole universe one day will come to an end. 2 Peter 3:10. With a big bang. I started to blow my balloon up and pop it, but I didn't know if that would be... He said start off with a bang, you know. But blow up that balloon and pop it. But God is going to bring... Is it going to take Him 12 to 20 billion years to wind this world down naturally? No. And it didn't take Him that long to start it naturally either. We have a great God. We have a good God. But the thing we need to ask ourselves, are we prepared to meet this God? Are we really willing to weigh the influences of His world in our hearts and in our mind and come to the conclusion that David did, that the heavens do declare His glory? And His earth, His firmament, shows only His handiwork, not that of evolution. Does God really exist? Certainly, certainly He really exists. I want to leave you with a final quote and a final question. This is taken from Think Tank Transcript on pages 11 and 12. Mr. Wattenberg speaks. He's talking to Richard Dawkins, the evolutionist. He says, in that great scientific journal, U.S. Today, it is said that people who are religious live longer and healthier lives. Does that perhaps put a Darwinian bonus on believing in religion? Mr. Dawkins, well, I could well do say yes. It's perfectly plausible to me. I've read the same study, and I think it might well be true. It could be a placebo effect. And it could indeed have a highly beneficial effect on health, particularly to where stress-related diseases are concerned. Mr. Wattenberg, So if I want to advise my viewers, I would say, for example, what Professor Dawkins says is true but harmful. I would like you to believe something that's false but healthy. Well, Mr. Dawkins, well, yeah, you could say that. I mean, it depends on whether you value health or truth better or more. Mr. Wattenberg, which do you value? Mr. Dawkins, for myself, I would rather have a little bit less, live a little bit less long and know the truth. Mr. Wattenberg, suppose it is substantially longer and we are talking about your children rather than you. Well, yeah, okay. I mean, these are fascinating hypothetical questions. And I suppose there would come a trade-off point. But it's positively irresponsible to let listeners of this program go away with the idea that this is any major effect. Final question. If natural selection picks the fittest, Mr. Dawkins, according to your own theory, who will be the ultimate survivors? We will. We win both ways. Thank you.